You're listening to the Shared Security Show, exploring the trust you put in people and technology, hosted by Tom Esten, Scott Wright, and Kevin Johnson. Welcome to episode 218 of the Shared Security Show. And joining me this week are the world's greatest co-hosts, Scott Wright and Kevin Johnson.
Yeah, that's us.
Yes. Just like, you know how there's the world's greatest hot dogs, the world's greatest hamburger.
I think it was a unanimous vote, too.
Yes.
No, it wasn't, unless I wasn't given a vote. Because I don't believe I'm the world's greatest of anything.
You don't get a choice. I just get to name you.
So then it was unanimous vote.
That's right. Well, welcome everyone to this week's show. We have some very interesting and possibly controversial topics to enrage Kevin for this.
I'm not enraged. I'm perfectly calm. Yes, I took my calming pills.
Well, let's start with the first topic, which is the news about the Lapsus hacker group that have supposedly breached Microsoft and Okta. And wow, well, bless you.
Sorry, I'm allergic to Okta. I'm just sneezing like crazy.
You should take some medication for that. But so this has been all over the news in the cybersecurity community. I'd say less news about the Microsoft breach and a lot more news about Okta for several reasons. What happened was that Okta was breached apparently back in January through a third-party contracting firm that does, I guess, their support. Would that be a way to say that? They're like a third-party support? And so this hacker got access to this individual. They didn't say how, by the way. Like they didn't release any information on how this person got access to supposedly a laptop. But then the Lapsus group released these screenshots showing, and I believe it was Cloudflare, right, that was the customer that they had access to basically reset users' passwords. I mean, pretty serious stuff. Before we get into kind of the controversy around this, it might be good to explain what Okta is, maybe for people listening that may not be familiar with what Okta is.
Yeah, I think it's pretty simple. Single sign-on, right? They handle authentication and authorization for systems at a very simplistic way to define them, I think, right? Yeah. They've been around forever. I laughed because earlier this week I was at, was it this week or last week? I was at the HIMSS Cybersecurity Forum, and I was speaking. And this morning, I got an email from an Okta salesperson because they saw that I attended the HIMSS Cybersecurity Forum, and they wanted to know if I wanted to get in touch with them to see how Okta can solve my problems or anything else like this. And I was very, very tempted to write back and say, "Oh no, I know what Okta is. I've read all about you."
Most recently, I've read.
I know all about them now. Yeah. About
you. I feel like at a certain point, your salespeople should say, "You know, maybe we should pause on the outbound sales requests." Right,
but I think it's really important though to realize they are. You know, it's a very important part of trust in a lot of enterprises. We call web single sign-on. Right. So, in the old days, back when we were kids, and you know, enterprise software was always installed in your data center, and you know, you could do single sign-on between your applications in a different way. But now you're on the web, and you've got, you know, Slack and Salesforce and all these places that you want to log into. And Okta basically is one of those providers that uses token-based authentication, I believe. So you authenticate to an identity provider, and once you are authenticated, you can go to any of the sites you've kind of signed up for.
Right. So apparently 2.5% of Okta's customers were impacted. And this, by the way, is all recent information that was posted on Okta's blog, because the controversy is that they didn't notify their customers that they had a breach, or a third party that is used by Okta had a breach and apparently didn't think this was a big deal. Is that a correct statement?
Oh, I think it's a correct statement. I laugh at it because not your statement, but the whole idea of that. I like their latest, at least the latest statement of theirs that I read, where they're like, only 2.5% of our customers. And it's like, that sounds really, really small. But how many users is that? Right? Like if one of your customers was the US government, right?
Right.
That's a significant, like you could make the claim only one of my clients got breached, but that's huge, right? Like I believe that they've been downplaying the risk and thing.
Yeah.
And I will say also that I'm not sure why we would expect anything else from an organization at this point in an investigation, right? Like I know that when I did forensics and incident response and was involved in all that more, we were always told keep the amount of information you reveal publicly low to start with, because one, you don't want to release stuff that's not true, right? And especially like look at what Okta's done, right? Okta has released multiple statements. Every time they release a statement, they basically contradict the statement they made previously. We weren't hacked. Well, it was somebody else. Oh, well, maybe it was us. Oh, yeah, it was us, but it was only 2.5% of our people. Right? Like that causes problems.
It's very strange. Because, and there's also, there was a forensic investigation that was done by this third party, but that didn't wrap up, I guess, until March something.
Right. Right.
And that's not in Okta's official statement, but I believe the CISO or the CSO or whoever the founder at Okta is, he was tweeting that that's what happened. So there, you're right. There's a lot of information that's kind of all over the place of like what actually did happen. And it's really hard to say what did.
I think it's almost an unavoidable problem, because as soon as you're hacked, there is a victim who should be notified. And that's, you know, what the transparency is all about, right?
Should they be?
Well, wouldn't you want to be if you were a potential victim?
I didn't ask, did they want to be notified? I said, should they be notified?
Well, I think they should be if they are potentially at risk of having a loss because of it.
But when?
As soon as it's potentially known, right?
So here's my issue with this. And I want to be very clear.
I see where he's going.
I'm really, really on the side of notify. If I, let's be blunt, when Security Ideas had the problem with our training site, the minute we had enough information to publish, we published, right? We published well before the average says we needed to. I fall completely on the side of transparency. Let people, hey, I think there's a problem. I got this issue here. I think I got something going on, right? Like, let me tell you about it. Here's the problem. Especially in an organization that is as entwined in systems as Okta is. Okay, let's say they found out today. They were notified today that their Scott Wright account has been compromised, and they tell you, okay? And then 3 days later, as they go through their investigation, they find out that their Tom Esten account and their Kevin Johnson accounts were also compromised, right? And now they tell Tom and I, there's going to be lashback, I don't know if that's a real right word.
Backlash? But
where I'm like, well, why didn't you tell me 3 days ago when you told Scott? Yeah. Right? Like, why did you wait?
Information.
I pay you lots of money. Why am I... And even worse, right, you start to then fall into legal requirements. Isn't Okta a public company? Mm-hmm. Right? So as a public company in the United States, they have a fiduciary responsibility to do certain things for their stockholders. And if they don't have enough information for them to believe they can do a good notification, I can see the argument that they're violating the law if they give you information that they don't know is 100% correct. No, I want to be clear. I think all of that is a BS excuse for not notifying. But I do believe that you want the organization to notify when they have enough information to notify correctly. And I'm gonna flip it out of the cyber and go into the human life, right? Mm-hmm. There's a car accident. Person gets hit. They die. The firefighters look at it and go, hey, I ran the tag on that car and it's Kevin Johnson's car. That must be Kevin Johnson's dead body in the car. So let me announce to the world that Kevin Johnson died. Right? They don't do that. What they do is they investigate, they send the body, they privately notify people, they think, they try to attempt to make sure that it's right. They follow this process because the impact of telling people that somebody died is bigger than the weight. So I think the problem is, and this is something I've argued with constantly, is that security always says, well, why didn't you tell us? Well, maybe they didn't know.
Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of factors, right? And I think, you know, every business has to have that, you know, responsible judgment that decides when they have enough information to release, you know, responsibly. I just thought, I don't know if it was in this article that we were looking at or if it was another one where there, you know, the CSO or somebody at Okta said they were disappointed in how long it actually took, you know, from January to whatever. Right? So it tells me they were concerned that there was...
Because the third party was doing the investigation.
Yeah,
right.
That's why.
And I can understand that disappointment. And let me be very clear. I'm well aware of companies. Before we have another Reddit comment that says I'm a shill for companies. I don't trust most companies to give the right information out. When Okta first announced, I said, that's BS. At this point, I actually still believe we're going to find out more is out there. We still don't have the full story.
And that's what people are pushing Okta to release that, the forensics report. Because
the problem is they're going to push to get release of information and it's still not going to be complete.
Yeah. And did you see, it's funny to see the hacking group posting tweets kind of tearing apart their Okta statement and saying, nope, that's not true. That's not true. That's not true. So, you know, you had the hacking group saying one thing, Okta saying another. And unfortunately, the customers are the ones asking, what the hell? What am I supposed to believe? And so it's kind of people now are scrambling. If you're an Okta customer, especially this week, you're kind of doing your own kind of analysis to see. And in our show notes, we'll link Cloudflare, which I think had a great how they documented their response and how they handled it.
That's what we want to see.
That is exactly how we want to see it.
Yes.
Right.
Here's what we did. Here's what we looked at. Here's what we don't know. Here's what we do know. And here's how you can do it yourself. Yeah. That's
perfect. Yeah.
That's the best type of notification.
That's right. So we'll talk about more updates as we get them. You know, pay attention to our Reddit site, subreddit. Sorry, and we'll post interesting developments that come from that. But it's been a week for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
So imagine this scenario. You're out of the office unexpectedly and a colleague pings you because they need access to some system you have credentials for. Now, our listeners would never send passwords over email or Slack, right? But what about your coworkers? How many organizations out there are sending logins back and forth in plain text? Worse yet, how many just store all of their logins on a shared spreadsheet? We all know that human errors are the biggest threat to your organization's security. But did you know that weak or stolen passwords account for over 80% of all data breaches? Now, there are tools out there that can allow you to share credentials, set access permissions, and monitor the dark web for stolen logins. And Keeper Security's enterprise password management platform does just that. Keeper locks down logins, payment cards, confidential documents, API keys and database passwords in a patented zero-knowledge encrypted vault, and it takes less than an hour to deploy across your organization. Sign up for a Keeper free trial for your organization today and get a free 3-year personal plan. Stop sharing emails and spreadsheets with the keys to the kingdom. Get started by visiting keepersecurity.com/sharedsecurity. So with that, let's go into our favorite segment, which is Aware Much.
Yes, indeed, Tom. It's that time again. Time to ask, do you aware much? The focus of this segment is to highlight security and privacy issues that end users and employees should be aware of so they can understand the risks from attacks like phishing and social engineering and severe sneezing attacks. The segment is brought to you by ClickArmor, the first fully gamified security awareness and engagement platform. So today we want to talk about something called the browser-in-the-browser attack. We learned that a security researcher that goes by the handle Mr. Docs did some interesting research and discovered it's fairly easy to replicate the pop-up login windows that are used by many major identity providers like Microsoft, Facebook, and Apple. And it turns out that people are really well conditioned to just trust these pop-up windows that make it convenient to log in through what we call web single sign-on, where you can log in via an account you already have with a trusted company. Now, the fake pop-up window appears to have a secure URL string right in the address bar. But what's interesting is it isn't a real address bar at all. It's created by the attacker who owns the malicious web page that you landed on. So why is this possible? Well, it's a pop-up window. In HTML, it doesn't necessarily have to have an address bar that's always shown. And so other web pages that are in the main browser always have that address bar, but a pop-up doesn't. So it can just be a web form created from code on that page. But this does become a vulnerability of a sort when people believe it's got a real secure-looking URL when it's really just made up to have a completely fake address bar. So the way you might see this is if you happen to be lured to a web page by a phishing message or a link in a user-generated content on a social media site or whatever. And you really just need to be vigilant whenever you see a pop-up window. You can't actually trust if there's a URL shown in that window that it is correct. You need to look at the page where it popped up from, which is where the malicious code would actually be. So this is something I'd like to ask Tom and Kevin. You know, what do you think? Why do you think companies actually use these pop-up windows? Are they necessary? And can you actually stop this in any way?
I think it's just because they don't want to redirect you from the page. That's the most, from a usability perspective, that probably makes the most sense.
Yeah, they'd have to reload the page coming back, et cetera, right?
Well, then there's session issues and things you have to deal with. So they probably just use the pop-up and...
Yeah, well, and how you get back to the right page. That if you start to redirect away, now you have the, open redirection problems and things like that, right? This was actually I hesitate to use the word solution. But this was actually a solution to other vulnerabilities, right?
Interesting.
I don't know. I think this is interesting. I think Mr. Docs did an interesting thing. I would ask if Mr. Docs has seen the browser exploitation framework from, 2004, 2005?
Oh,
Beef. That had this exact... type of social engineering as part of the exploitation back then.
Very right? Similar.
I think this is, I'm glad he put this out here. This is,
oh
I'm
yeah, not trying I to like mean, it.
Right. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he's done anything new. This is not a new.
He put a new twist on it, I think.
And it's a little bit new because we all rely on it so much.
We rely
on those pop-ups.
That doesn't make it new. That makes it easier for us to accomplish. He created a web page that, and again, I'm not demeaning what he did. I think what he did is great. I'm thrilled he put it out there. But he created a web page, and if you go to the web page, it does a pop-up that pretends to be a different site and replicates the look and feel of that site.
Sure.
Yeah. I think what he's done here too is giving maybe red teams another option. Right. When you're doing pen testing or phishing assessments, things like that, this is now something that maybe we've forgotten about. He's got a GitHub page where you can download, different templates and things like that to do this.
So. And that's why I say is I think what he's doing is great. It's it's pushing more information. It's just not new. And the reason I'm saying that, why I'm harping on that is the social engineering aspect of things. We've been trying to fix for years and we're never going to fix
it. Well, it's always going to be an issue.
Right. Never fix it.
And I'll point out, and I think that it's actually the perfect timing. I feel like I'm now a corporate shill for ClickArmor. I think his main thing in his blog post where he says, I want to know if the check the URL thing is as weak as worthwhile as it is. What he's done is just given another example why the common security awareness advice, which is asinine and has been asinine since 1873, of check the URL is useless. That isn't a solution. It hasn't been a solution for decades, right? And I'm not saying he's wrong to ask the question. He's right to ask the question because too many people, let's pick an example randomly that has no relevance on this. KnowBe4, a company that sells security awareness training, will ignore the fact that they're founded by a criminal that is unapologetic and worthless. Like, he's a waste of carbon. Sadly named the same as me by first name. KnowBe4's training still perpetuates the antiquated and invalid and ineffective check the URL. And so Mr. Docs here is basically saying, Kevin Mitnick, you're a moron. This isn't the way to do it because of this, right? So I think that's awesome. I think it's great, and we need security awareness companies to actually teach people stuff they can do that's effective in checking the URLs. There's my rant.
Amazing. Amazing. I don't pay Kevin for this stuff, by the way.
And this is brought to you by.
Matter of fact, you should. No, but that's what I'm saying is I don't want to be a, joke and say corporate shill again, but I like the phrase. I'm absolutely a corporate shill. I will shill secure ideas all over the place, which sounds inappropriate. Did that just raise our rating?
I don't know. Yeah. We don't censor anything on this podcast, so who knows?
I think that this is a great example. It's a great story to talk about for the AwareMuch because what he is doing or they are doing or I don't know the person, what they are doing is pushing forward something that says, hey, do better.
Yeah,
and exactly.
That's what I want to see from security awareness. Do better.
That's
so
great,
I'll shut up now.
Great conclusion. So this installment of AwareMuch has been brought to you by ClickArmor. You're probably painfully aware that shortly after you take any kind of security awareness course, you start to forget the tips and guidance, if there was anything useful there in the first place, or any misinformation. But having taught security awareness for over 10 years, I've learned why people are generally the biggest vulnerability in a cyber attack. And one of the primary reasons is they don't get a chance to practice and learn from making risk decisions often enough. Organizations need to do a much better job at proactively strengthening end user awareness through regular exercises. Now, end users don't really get a chance to practice in the annual courses that much, and they sure don't get to practice on a regular basis in a way that helps them understand and build muscle memory. So clearly, this is a problem that traditional solutions can't really address because who wants to take a boring online course module every week, right? So ClickArmor makes it easy to engage employees in practicing those risk decisions in a fun way. We now provide automated, immersive 3-minute challenges every week that are quick and effective at exercising people's ability to spot and avoid attacks. We do this with our virtual inbox phishing simulator, where you see 3 email messages to be analyzed each week, and it's really quick. And we're the first fully gamified platform for security awareness training and engagement. And it's the only way an organization can reliably build a strong security culture that's inclusive and positive, and using a perpetual series of gamified exercises. Now, visit clickarmor.ca today and sign up for our 5-day challenge to see an accelerated trial of our weekly challenges in just 1 week. As one of our participants said, holy smokes, that was fast. And then the next day, it really hit home how educational this is. So I just love that quote. Hope to see you all soon at ClickArmor's next 5-day challenge. Just at clickarmor.ca, you can sign up. And that's awesome. It for this installment of AwareMuch.
So we have a few minutes left here to talk about our last story. And I think this was one submitted by you, Kevin.
Emailed you and said, hey, what about
this
story?
This is interesting. Yeah.
We'll ignore the other story I sent you that was from
from 2013. Yeah. but this story, which was relevant to today and what's going on in the world, a popular NPM package was updated to wipe Russia and Belarus systems to protest the Ukraine invasion. So just briefly, this package that is used by a lot of different types of software for inter-process communication, or known as IPC. We won't get into the technical details of that, but it's downloaded 1.1 million downloads weekly. So it's a pretty popular package that's used. And what ended up happening was the developer decided to check for the location through their IP address and if whoever was using this as part of their software, and it would essentially wipe systems, apparently.
My understanding is it overwrote arbitrary files. It didn't wipe
correct.
The whole system.
Well, not wipe the whole system. So maybe the
I'm not saying that makes
clickbait
it better.
Title, but yeah. And so this is another way of like protesting, obviously, what's going on in Ukraine. But this is really concerning, too, of like you can do this with any open source type component that has a similar functionality now. It doesn't have to be about a protest.
Can we not say open source there? We can do this to any software package that we
well, any, you're right.
And do updates.
Correct.
Right. Like I'm an open source fanatic. This is not an open source project. Problem, Microsoft could decide that then
that's
Windows
true.
12
yep.
would overwrite arbitrary files because it was based in Russia. I point that out only because I, and we're going to talk old now, in 1991, when I was responsible for my very first commercial network, we ran Artisoft Lantastic.
Oh, gosh.
And we bought machines, and we bought this machine from, I want to say, Costco, right? Like it was just like a the owner of the company went and bought a machine, brought it in, plugged it in. When they plugged it in, the entire network shut off.
Wow.
And you would unplug it, the network would stay off until you rebooted every machine. The minute you would plug that one into the network, a coax BNC network, the entire network would shut off. And the reason was that machine thought it was in Puerto Rico, I believe.
Oh my gosh.
And the Artisoft software, not Puerto Rico, Mexico. Yeah. And the Artisoft software was only allowed to be run in the US with the license we had. And so it shut off the entire network, right? We troubleshot that for weeks until we finally got a word from them on how to fix it, right? This is not a new problem. I think this is a very blatant example of it, right? He did fix it.
Yes. Yes. Well, good stuff. Good stuff.
All right.
All right. Well, with that, I think that's all we have time for this week. But thank you both, as always, for being the most wonderful co-hosts on the planet. And thank all of you for listening and watching the podcast. Much
you
appreciated.
You make it so easy, Tom.
I try to.
That's exactly right. Like, Tom just sets the bar so low for us.
Yes, I do.
He doesn't have high expectations. Not
that's right.
That he's not that good. I said it wrong.
That's right. That's right. But we'll talk to you all next week. That's all for this week's show. Visit our website, sharedsecurity.net, for all previous episodes and to sign up for our email newsletter. Looking for shared security merch? Be sure to check out our shop at store.sharedsecurity.net. Don't forget, you can always find us on Twitter at SharedSec. And if you like this episode, please share it with friends and colleagues. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week for another episode of the Shared Security Show.